From HanselMinutes.com, it's Hansel Minutes, a weekly discussion with web developer and technologist Scott Hanselman. This is Lawrence Ryan announcing show number 564. In this episode, Scott talks with Mina Markham about building the Hillary Clinton UI pattern library, known as Pantsuit.
Hi, this is Scott Hanselman. This is another episode of Hansel Minutes. Today I'm talking with Mina Markham. She worked at Hillary for America. She organized the Front Porch Conference. She's worked at IBM Design and all over. How are you?
I'm doing great. How are you doing?
I am thrilled, and I'm very happy to be talking with you. I found out about you when I was looking at your UI pattern library. You built a design system, but not just a design system. You built a presidential design system for then-candidate Hillary Clinton.
Yes, I did. It was a lot of fun. It was actually the first project I did when I started working there, and it was the longest spanning project. I did it the entire time I was there. So over the span of like 18 months, I worked on two separate versions of this pattern library.
And how does that work? Like someone comes up with, when you have all these, at the time, there are all these different presidential candidates and there's all these logo designers, but like, is there some designer that comes up with like the language that you're going to use, or were you part of the language, the Hillary Clinton language team, or how does that work?
Well, there were two different versions of Pantsuit, of the library, for each different version of the site that we launched, the main site, HillaryClinton.com. When the campaign originally launched back in April 2015, the site had one kind of look, and I was charged with sort of retrofitting and creating a pattern library based on the site as it existed. So I had to take a design that was already in place by people who were no longer working on the project and figure out a way to make a reusable system out of something that already existed. For the second version of the site, I actually worked with our designer, one of our lead visual designers, Victor Ng. He redesigned HillaryClinton.com, and based on the redesign, I was also redoing the library at the same time. So he and I worked pretty closely together to make sure that the library I was creating directly reflected his designs, and we would update each as need be. So with a lot of like rapid iteration and a lot of like pair design coding happening.
Mm-hmm. Now, political campaigns have more than just like one website, right? They have different entry points and different other mini sites and things like that. Is that correct?
That's correct. At least for us, we had the main site, which was the .com, and that was us that hosted our homepage and state-specific pages, policy pages, and our blog and like content-driven pages. Underneath the umbrella of HillaryClinton.com, we had other platforms and apps like our donations platform, which is a separate code base, our event RSVP platform, which again is a separate code base. We had one-off sites for things like our fact checker that we did for debates, and we had like policy-driven microsites like the College Calculator or something, a policy picker where you can pick the kind of policies that the issues that were important to you, and it would lay out like your platform as presented by Hillary Clinton. So we had like a lot of different apps all under the HillaryClinton.com.
Mm-hmm. So it's almost, I mean, when you're saying a platform, like the candidate is off figuring out their platform and you're building a platform that's a visual platform to build literally everything up on top of that.
As the candidate herself was building out her policy platform, we were updating the site to reflect both the policies, and basically we were trying to make sure that everything on the site was reflecting the message and the vision of the candidate herself. So it was a lot of like rapid fire, like updates whenever something needed to be changed.
Uh-huh. So let me, because a lot of the people who are listening aren't designers, let me ask a couple of maybe dumb questions, and you'll please forgive me if I do. Why can't you do something like, I don't know, one big CSS file and we all just include that? Like when does a solution like this go from being, just include this you know, super duper .css and that'll handle everything versus it becomes a system.
The reason we wanted to do a system was because we had so many different individual like products and different projects under in different code bases. No one ever needed all of the library that I made. No one ever used every single thing that was in it. So in the interest of making sure that our front-end code was lightweight as possible and our sites were as fast as possible, we built a system so that people could just take the parts of it that they needed as opposed to taking absolutely everything that was there. It resulted in, one, our engineers were able to move a lot faster because they could just like take some button styles out or just take some styles out for headlines and things, just the parts they needed and leave the rest out of it.
Okay. So this is a lot more modular. It is overly, what I described is very simplistic for a system that is this big.
Yeah, because there was no way to anticipate how it was going to be used. I had to create something that could be used in effective isolation. Like, you need to be able to take any one part of it and plug it into any kind of code base and have it work and not have to do a lot of like tweaking and a lot of like extra coding on top of it just because of the pace that we were developing at.
Mm-hmm. And you based the core architecture on this concept that I'd not heard of before called ITCSS?
Yes, I did. It's a concept that Harry Roberts, he goes by CSS Wizardry. He came up with this brilliant system where a lot of times when you write CSS, you kind of almost work against the principle, the cascade of it. You try to fight the CSS, because since CSS naturally like inherits styles from the top down to the bottom, and sometimes when you're writing it, you almost go against that principle. Whereas with ITCSS, the idea is that you start off with really broad scale, really grand styles, and you narrowly get more specific and more narrow as you go down in your style sheet. So at the end, you're left with very specific like versus classes that handle like one particular property or one particular declaration. And at the very top of it, you'll have things that go where you'll have like your box sizing or your styles on like the HTML tag and like the main tags there. So I really like that principle because it lended itself well to modularity, but also it lended itself to like not writing a lot of like overtly specific CSS and a lot of like bloated code because you weren't effectively trying to undo something you did before.
Hmm. It seems like, from a layman's perspective, that it applies rigor to something that I personally, because I'm not a designer, I just hack CSS together. I've never applied that level of kind of rigor or formality to my CSS. This is a whole framework within which, like a name, it's a naming convention. It's a way to focus your classes and their purpose and their scope.
Yeah, I try to do that as much as possible because what I've discovered is that a lot of people, even a lot of front-end developers who do more JavaScript and more like logic-oriented things, they don't like writing CSS because they've gotten used to the idea that it's kind of haphazard and it's very easy to like things to break very easily. I've kind of figured out that that's because people tend to write their CSS mimicking the HTML structure, and they kind of tightly couple the two so that if you change one, you end up inadvertently having to change the other or something might break. So The principle behind using something like ITCSS and using really great naming conventions is to make it so that your CSS file one is easily read by a human. We use naming conventions that if you look at the name of the class, you could pretty easily tell what the styles and what that class purpose is. At least I try to name my classes in a way that if you saw the name of the class, you could know what exactly it is was referencing. But also, I wanted to be able to remove the styles from the structure of the page so that if you happen to move around your markup a little bit, you didn't have to go back and then rewrite some CSS. It should just work. And I found that, especially when we were working in a very rapid fire environment like the campaign was, it's the less work you can do, the better. So like being able to just change class, just move around class names and not have to like redo all of your HTML structure or vice versa. Like it made it so that there was a lot of like, it wasn't a lot of lifting to get started. It wasn't a lot of lifting to change your styles.
Mm-hmm. And when you're putting together a site that's going to get, you know, I assume, you know, tens of millions, if not hundreds of millions of hits, you're going to want to hit everybody. And it's going to have to be really, really inclusive. So does this work? Like, is it accessible? Is it compliant with all the things for screen readers and low vision and all those kinds of things?
Yeah, I tried to make the site as compliant as possible. Because, like you said, it's particularly when you're applying to work at the highest office in the land, like you want to make sure you can reach everyone who's attempting to find out more information about you. So I wanted to make sure I removed as many barriers as possible from being able to access the site. And so that included, one, making sure, like you said, that screen readers could read the site properly. And to do that, I tried my best to code every page with the proper hierarchy and the proper HTML tags so that the screen readers would know the hierarchy of the content and would be able to better interpret what the content meant. In addition to that, keyboard navigation was something I tried to pay attention to. There's a lot of people who use keyboard only, aren't able to use a mouse or whatnot. So they use a lot of use keyboard navigation to go around the site. And I wanted to make sure that if you were using a tab key or an arrow key to go through our site, you were able to hit every single thing you needed to hit. You didn't get into any traps where you weren't able to access, like, for example, our drop-down menu or our navigations, our main navigation. I just wanted to make sure that everything, you'd be able to get around the site without much difficulty. At the same time, when you're using keyboard navigation, you want to make sure that there's focus states so people know when they're moving the cursor with the tab key, you want to be able to see where you are located at any given time. Like with the mouse, you're able to tell where your mouse is. You can see the cursor, but with the tab keys, if you don't specifically style focus states, you may not always be able to tell where you are on a page. The funny thing is that the browser does this for you automatically. Like it just comes with focus states, but lots of frameworks inadvertently like remove that styling, and some developers don't know that they need to add that back so that people are able to see where they are. So I worked with our designer to make sure that we specifically styled all of our focus states so that even though I removed the default browser styles because we didn't like the way they looked, we made sure that we added them back, that they matched our brand and people could still tab through and know where they were.
I see. So there is the stuff that the browser does by default. You removed it because you didn't like the look of it, but you made sure that no behaviors were removed. No expectations were not met when someone did something like tab over something.
Yeah. And there's nothing wrong with moving, because I think, on a Mac anyway, there's this like default, like blue shadowy outline when you tab over something. And lots of people don't necessarily like that look, but just if you're going to remove it, make sure that you then style that look appropriately. And we did a separate style between hover and focus states, because the gut reaction is, well, I'll just style the hover states and the focus states the exact same. That doesn't necessarily always work. So we wanted to make sure that when you were tabbing versus hovering over something, you would know the distinction by being able to visually see it. One important thing that we had to make sure we kept in mind was color contrast. A lot of the times people think that just changing the color of something is enough of a visual indicator, but lots of people are colorblind and aren't able to perceive that shift in color. So making sure that you have some kind of like deep contrasting color palette so that they can visually see the difference. Even if they can't see the difference in color, they'll be able to see the difference in the shading. So keeping stuff in mind like that, where just making sure that it's always visually, you're always able to visually perceive the difference in something, even if it's all in black and white.
So this is all very modern HTML, modern CSS. Does this end up being one big CSS file, or are you using a CSS library that is generating CSS?
It's several, like dozens of small CSS files. Or actually several small SAS files. And we are using a Gulp/Webpack based build system to compile all of those files into one main CSS file, which is then included into the application. That was for the main site. Because Pantsuit was also used by things that were outside products, I also used that compiled CSS, and the build system would then publish it to the CDN, and so they would be able, our engineers would be able to just pull a link off the CDN and include it for any other application they were using. So our build system would take all of my, like, dozens of small SAS files, compile them into one big CSS file, and then would publish them both to a internal NPM module that you could then include inside of your application, or to the an S3 bucket for our CDN, and then they could pull it down with just a link tag. So there's two different ways that people would consume Pantsuit.
Interesting. And is it possible to test something like this is maybe a dumb question, but can you test CSS without looking at it, like the way you unit test JavaScript?
Not really. There's a thing called visual regression test, which I never fully implemented because it just was kind of out of scope of what I was working on. But to do something like testing CSS, I really just do like visual tests. I would do visual debugging using this thing called pesticide.io, which would essentially just add an outline to every element on the page. And you can kind of see if your layout is doing something unexpected or kind of funky, you can kind of, that helps you to see what is happening. But as far as like automated tests for CSS, the only thing I would do was I would lint my CSS based on some linting rules that I wrote. And it would just help with the formatting of the files themselves, but it didn't really like check to see if it worked properly or if it looked properly. With the SAS, with compiling, if there was a missing punctuation or something, the file just wouldn't compile. So you would notice it was broken because no CSS would be loaded. But that's about as far as it would go.
I see. But I mean, could you push bad CSS out and it would make it all the way out to production? Or like you said, you'd catch some of that in the linting process and it would literally break the build.
I kind of tested it really rigorously, just visually speaking, because of that, because so many different people were using the finished product that I didn't want to risk breaking anything in production. So I did pretty rigorous testing, just visual, like testing just by looking at it. That's about all I could do. Also, we did Simver for Pantsuit so that even if I happen to, because every once in a while I would inadvertently push a broken build to prod, but it would be versioned so that no one would actually, it never would make it to the live site unless someone went and manually updated that dependency. So there was a lot of different safeguards to try not to push broken CSS to the site, but occasionally, you know, it happened.
This might be, again, I keep apologizing for saying this is a dumb question, but I'm realizing that on the front end, I am really unfamiliar with how things work. And when I was doing CSS, you know, many years ago, when I was writing my own, before CSS kind of became its own practice, right, where there were professional front-end engineers, right? There was just so much less formality to it. Your build system is really rigorous and integrated into the build system of the entire site, right? I mean, you're using a strongly typed language like with SAS that's catching things and allowing you to do reuse. It's as similar as writing C or C++. I mean, it's pretty serious stuff.
Yeah, I come from a design background. I used to be a designer, and I slowly weighed my way and taught myself front-end development and front-end engineering. So I use SAS as kind of like a starter drug or like a entryway drug to programming. SAS has a lot of like traditional programming concepts within it that help me to learn more programming languages. So I've just started getting used to writing CSS in a way that is much more like, yeah, much more modular, much more cleaner, and just more deliberate, and just making sure that I do things. In a way that they are very intentional, and I just try not to do anything completely haphazard, because that's how a lot of the frustrations with the traditional frustration people have with CSS, that's where they come from, is that people are a little bit more haphazard with their naming conventions or with their styling, the styling methodology and things like that.
Yeah, that's very well said. I like that, intentional and deliberate, because I know that when I paid a designer to redesign my blog, you know, it was glorious and it was organized. And then I wanted to change something, you know, mm-hmm. and I threw it at the end, you know, and now 3 years later, I'm on version 5 and it's 10% garbage and 90% glorious. And the garbage is entirely my fault because I didn't think about the pyramid and the, like you point out, you know, the alterations of components as it works its way down the, or up the pyramid, depending on how you look at it.
Yeah, and like I said, the IT CSS, that is a really smart, really well thought out methodology. And I think that it solves a lot of people's frustrations with CSS, and that it helps you think about it in much more deliberate fashion.
The build system is not just, you're not just building the CSS on the website, but one of the things that separates a style guide from just some CSS is documentation. This is a system like Bootstrap is a system. There's a whole series of documentation behind this for people to sit down and immediately become productive with it, isn't there?
Yeah, that was part of my deliverable when I finished this project, because this system that I built didn't really do anyone any good if they didn't know how to use it. So I kind of tried to document as I would make this, as I was building the system, as I was building components. I used this CSS notation called KSS Node. And what it would do is it parses through comments that I would make inside my SAS files, and it uses those comments to generate static pages that were showcasing and documenting the components I was making. So it made it had a twofold result. One, the documentation itself lived inside of the code base. So if someone was just looking through the code base, they would be able to read the documentation that way. But also it helped me to kind of automate the documentation of it pretty quickly, because whenever I would make a change inside of a CSS file, I could quickly update the comments next to it, and I would have my documentation just re-render and update that way. And one of the things I heard from my fellow engineers on the team was that how well documented this was. And it really had the effect that people were able to kind of jump in and get going very quickly, and they didn't have to find me to ask a lot of questions about how to use it. It was just kind of there, and it made it so that our project, our timelines moved much, much faster.
Interesting. So a documentation syntax for CSS. So it's embedded within the comments within the CSS itself.
Yeah. I would just write, in SAS, there's this thing called silent comments where the comments themselves don't get outputted to the actual compiled CSS, but they live inside the SAS files. And this notation would use those comments and generate the HTML markup that was needed to both present the UI component, but also it would spit out the raw markup so people could just copy and paste the markup into their own app.
Okay, interesting. So then that means that it's not just, you know, taking some markdown or some files, you know, some text out of comments, but you're actually seeing the button next to the, here's the style to use to get that button. It's live.
Yeah, it's actual live and living. It's a living and breathing style guide where you can see and interact with the components themselves, as well as seeing the markup you would need to recreate that in your own app. So it had kind of a twofold of showing people what it should look like. So if that, for whatever reason, they were using it and it didn't look quite like they were expecting, they could kind of go back to the documentation and see like what happened and maybe figure out where they went wrong. But also it was a way for people to like just really kind of see how these things lived outside of the context of a larger app.
Mm-hmm. Now you organized a conference called the Front Porch Conference. Kind of a front-end developer conference, is that right?
Yeah, I'm one of the co-organizers. Chris Williams, one of my good friends down in Dallas, he started the conference, and I helped him organize two different years, not last year, because obviously I was a little preoccupied, but I worked with him to run this conference the past 2 years. And we just tried to build a community, a front end developer community in Dallas, and kind of show that there is this tech scene there. And we just wanted a way to, like, you know, share knowledge and, you know, promote what we were learning to our fellow developers in the Dallas community.
So what would you say to someone like me who, you know, I know what HTML is, I know what CSS is, and I know what JavaScript is, but when you call it front end development and you talk to me about things like KSS and Nunjux and Assemble, and my brain starts to go, it's too much. And then you add SAS and it's like, well, I guess I'll just keep hacking it together. Where do I go to, if I'm not a designer, but I want to understand the world of the front-end developer, to try to get my head around this, because it's moving so fast?
So you're saying, where should I direct
people? What do I do? What would you tell me to do?
I would say, just the way I learned was I would read blog posts and read mainly CSS tricks, honestly. Like, that kind of is what got me really to understand how CSS works. And it doesn't just talk about CSS, it talks about pretty much everything to do with front end. So that was one place that I've gone that I've learned a lot about how to do front end development. But also, front end is kind of by default open source, because the browser has to be able to see the code, unlike, you know, back end applications that have to be compiled on the server. Like, you have access to the CSS, the HTML, and the JavaScript in your browser. So how I got into it is, I would just see something cool on someone's website. I would inspect the element. I would view the source and kind of just try to dig in and see what was happening. So I just learned by, like, playing around and dissecting other people's code. So what I would say is, just, if you see something you like, try to dig into it and figure out how it's being done.
Mm. So if I see a CSS, you know, system being used, I'm going to see it in view source, and then really dig into it and explore and say, well, you know, wow, this site that I respect or this company that I respect is using library foo or CSS style system bar. Why are they doing that? What were the decisions behind it? And then start exploring those people's blogs. And I assume they would talk about it on places like CSS Tricks.
Yeah, CSS Tricks. A Book Apart has a great series of very small, like, easily digestible books about front end, and they are geared towards beginners and people who don't necessarily know a lot about the topic they're talking about. So I think those books are actually a really good way to get started learning a little bit more about this. And it doesn't, because they're so small, they're very easy to read. You can read them in like a couple of hours. And I think that they actually help to get you started, and they don't require a lot of, like, upfront, like, diving in and, like, commitment to it.
Mm-hmm. Now, about a year ago, you made a GitHub project, and I went to your GitHub, and it's so much greener than mine. It has this lovely green graph of all your contributions. You made a project called Sassy Starter. Is that a good place for me to start?
That's a good place to start if you want to build, like, a static site pretty quickly. Essentially, I made that because when I started creating new front-end projects, I would always use a similar structure, a similar, like, file system, and I just wanted to not have to create the same thing multiple times. So I made it into a repo, and I put it up there because I thought someone else might enjoy it. But that's a good way for you to get started. It's like, at the very least, you can see the kind of way I structure my CSS, because it includes the file structure there for you. So you can kind of get an idea of, like, how that is structured. It also includes a very simple, like, gulp build system, so you can get your feet wet with how that particular system might work. It's a very good place to kind of, like, just start playing around with, like, front end code.
Very cool. So people can find you at mina.codes, mina.codes. And from there, they can see your speaking. You've spoken all over. They can see your work. You're in New York now, right?
Yeah, I live in Brooklyn now.
Very cool. And you're available if people are looking for a front-end designer who's done big stuff with amazing technologies. I really appreciate you taking the time to chat with me today.
Thank you for having me. I had fun.
This has been another episode of Hansel Minutes, and we'll see you again next week.